and welcome to The Unschooled Space, the podcast that's here to help parents embrace their personal journey into unschooling with all the challenges it's likely to bring. Each episode, I'll be looking at different aspects of unschooling and talking with other parents about their experiences. This is episode 5, and I'm your host, Esther Jones. And my guest today is Naomi Fisher. Naomi is a clinical psychologist and mother of 2 children, and her children were unschooled for 6 years and now attend a self-directed learning center. Naomi has just published a wonderful book about self-directed learning entitled Changing Our Minds, which explores the theory and research behind autonomous learning alongside lots of real-life examples. And today we talk particularly about why school can be really tough for our neurodivergent children and why these children in particular can thrive in an unschooling environment. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Hi, Naomi. Lovely to have you with us today. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
So it would be great if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came into the world of self-directed education.
Hey, so yes, my name's Naomi Fisher. I'm a clinical psychologist and an author. I wrote a book recently about self-directed education, funnily enough, which is called Changing Our Minds, How Children Can Take Control of Their Own Learning. I have 2 children who are 9 and 12, and they have never been to conventional school. We started off unschooling, and that was really very much led by what I saw as a real disconnect between my son's needs when he was starting school and what the local school was offering us. Local school was an excellent school. Everybody wanted to go there. And my son, he was about to be 4. So he was a very young, he was a July birthday. Went on to the parents' meeting and they gave me a list of key words to teach him over the summer. And it was a list of words like the, but, and, of, if, completely out of context. And it was just a moment when I was like, you know, I'm a psychologist, I'm a developmental psychologist as well as a clinical psychologist, and I've know all about learning through play and how learning works best in context and all of this kind of stuff. And now suddenly I'm going to be expected to try and teach my son this. I thought this is not going to go well. I know it's not going to go well on any level. And also I think it's developmentally inappropriate. I think that was what I particularly disliked. I felt that I was being coerced into a system, co-opted into a system, which I didn't agree with, but which I actually didn't have very much choice about, because that was kind of like what a good parent was going to do. And I could just see we'd get there in September and the good parents would have taught their children these words and we would not have learned the words. I knew that already. And I felt like, you know, I've never liked being told what to do too much. And my son is even more like me. He hates being told what to do. And yet already we hadn't even started school and we were being told what we had to do with our own time. And that felt really wrong to me.
Right.
So I said, okay, we're not going to do this. We're going to skip at least the first few years of school, was what I thought initially. And obviously, like everybody, I didn't know very much at that stage about unschooling. But I thought we'd just carry on pretty well doing what we'd been doing already, which was learning through play, learning through conversation, following his interests. Had a baby as well at the time. So it was quite hard work. But that we did that. We unschooled and I learned more and more about it. And then as he started to get older, I had thought that, you know, maybe school would be the right thing when he was about 7 or something like that. I think lots of people have this idea that you have a kind of play-based stage and then they get to 7 and suddenly they're all ready for school. And actually what happened was his path and the path of the children who'd gone to school just got more and more and more divergent. And also, I think my beliefs about learning and how I see children learn had been really developing all the way along. So by that point, I already thought what I think now, which is that it's really that choice is really important in children's learning, that if everybody's learning, that if you're allowed to choose what you do, then learning is easier and it flows and you can solve a lot of the problems that schools have by allowing people to have autonomy over their learning. So we unschooled for 6 years then. And so I had my daughter as well, who's 3 years younger. And then when they were about, well, when they were about 8 and 5, in fact, already by that point, it had become clear that they had hugely divergent interests. Like there was almost nothing on which they intersected, in which they liked. That Minecraft was about it. And even Minecraft, they liked to play it in really different ways. And my son had a preference for quite a lot of time at home doing things with us, but not all by himself, but not with other people. And he liked doing things on the computer. He liked making up games. He liked designing stuff. It was all quite in his head. My daughter loved being outside with other kids, ideally lots of other kids, with stuff she could really get her hands in and her feet in. You know, she's really sensory. So she'd like to be, if there was a puddle, she'd be right there in the middle of it. And if there was slime, it would be everywhere. And if there was paint, it would be everywhere. As an unschooling mother, I was basically spending all my time with one child saying, can we leave? Because if we were at home, right, my daughter would be saying, can we go out? Can we go out? Can we go out? And she didn't just want to go out. She wanted to go out to groups of other children. And my son, if we were out there, he would be saying, can we go home? When can we go home? Can we go home?
Yeah, Naomi, it's interesting because this is something I hear quite a lot. If everyone likes the same thing, I think it must just be so easy.
It must flow, yes.
I mean, I can only dream of that, to be honest with you, because we don't really have that. We have perhaps some more converging interests than what you're talking about, Minecraft, obviously.
And
I think a lot of parents feel really torn.
That was the thing that I found always torn. Never can we just go, everybody's happy. Because you're bringing up children who are not used to being told they've just got to suck it up. At school, that's what happens. You're there, you're not happy. Tough, really. You've got to suck it up. That's what school's about. Unschooling, that isn't the case. We're teaching them that they're, what they want is important and that they should express themselves. And they do.
And my feeling is that it's almost like they're kind of hitting the boundary of a family and what a family can do. It can be a little bit isolating, can't it?
You're just in your house.
Yeah.
But particularly if you have a child who doesn't really like to leave the house and doesn't really like to have visitors, then I think it can be quite isolating. I think lots of families do find that. I don't think it's not a fault of unschooling. It's just the reality of having a child like that. Yeah. The other thing I think that happens with unschooling is that we allow our children to be really different and we nurture that diversity. And so they are, you know. So my children, they've had choice over what they do and how they spend their time since really early on. And they choose to do almost entirely different things all the time. Their days look entirely different. And if they were at school, of course, they would have been made to do some of the same things. They would have been made to follow the same curriculum, but that didn't happen for them. So actually, they're probably more different than they would have been. And I think unschooled children are more different to each other than schooled children are because they haven't got that kind of, they haven't got the standardisation that happens.
Right, and they've never been able to conform, have they? Which I love, because I felt very much that I conformed. And I love that chapter in your book, actually, Naomi, about you at school and the difference, feeling different. And, you know, at school, that being different is quite a risky thing to do. You don't really want to be different. And, I applaud the children at school who are okay embracing that. I think they're very brave often. But I didn't. I wanted to be like everybody else.
And there's massive pressure, isn't there, to be the same, to be, because also it matters so much when you're at school, because if you don't have somebody to hang on to, if you don't have a friend or a group to be part of, you're on your own and everybody can see that you're on your own. And that just isn't the case for unschooled kids, because if, say, they don't, you know, they don't feel part of a group at a particular home ed group, you just go home. There isn't that kind of, we're here and I've got to stick it out all day now and no one's going to talk to me.
And that seems to me to be a really healthy thing, though, to take through to the future, knowing where your boundaries are, knowing where you're okay being with people when you say, do you know, it's time for me to be by myself.
It's brilliant, isn't it? I see that in my children and I just think, wow, I never had that. I do too. The way they can say, you know, my son's very specific. He'll say, I think after about an hour of this, I'll have had enough. Okay. You know, and I think I could never say that. Yeah. And it can be tricky when other people are involved because they don't expect that kind of self-awareness. And the real challenge in unschooling is when your child likes totally different things to you and your vision of what your life and what unschooling was going to be is really diametrically opposed. So, you know, you think that it's going to be all about playing in the forest and building dams in the river, and they think it's going to all be about online gaming and playing Mario or Minecraft. And then you've got this, who gets to choose? Does the parent say, this is what we're going to do? Or do they say, okay, this is what you need, you want to do, and we need to find a way for you to follow your interests? And that's I think, when unschooling really starts. And that's the real challenge.
Absolutely. Yeah, so your children right now are at a self-managed learning college, right?
That's right. So that was why we ended up seeking learning environments outside the home for them, because I just thought it was so bizarre that I could have a ratio of 1-2, you know, and yet feel totally split and like I was never meeting everybody's needs. So our kind of divergent thinking was that we moved to Paris in 2018 and they went to a self-directed school there, and that was a Sudbury modelled school. So that was entirely free choice, apart from the structure of the school, which is how the rules system, and they have a judicial committee that meets and the children and staff enforce the rules together and all that kind of thing. That's the structure. Apart right. from that, you go there and it's up to you how you spend your time. If you want to sit with your headphones on and watch YouTube videos all day, you can do that. And that's up to you. And then we did that for 2 years and then COVID happened. So for lots of reasons to do with COVID and Brexit, we basically decided we needed to come back to the UK. So we came back to the UK in May last year and we moved to Hove so that they could go to the self-managed learning college, which is just down the road. And they go there 4 hours a day. So it's part-time in the mornings. And there it's more structured. So they have learning advisors who offer different things, and they can choose to either attend group offerings that the learning advisors put on or arrange one-to-ones with them. But it's always the children who are managing, or the young people who are managing their learning.
Nothing but they still have that autonomy. Yeah, which is just so essential, isn't it?
To me, that's what the absolute key is. Whatever the environment is, if people are allowed to choose to be there and allowed to leave when they want to leave, then I think that would be far better, far healthier for everybody than what we have, which is formal structured learning environments where people are obliged to be there. I think it's that obligation which does a lot of the damage.
Yeah. And so in your book, can we talk a little bit about neurodiversity? So certainly the families that I know and parents I've spoken to, it's very common to have a neurodivergent child in the family. And often the neurodivergent child who has made everybody think again about education.
Isn't it amazing?
It's a terrible clash.
Yeah, I think it's right. great. I think these children, we are so lucky to have these children, because I think they've got a very clear-eyed view of the education system, and they're often extremely good at picking out coercion and control. I didn't feel I was being controlled at school, although obviously I was. I did what I was meant to do, got my results, you know, and I never really was aware of how controlling it was until actually both my children are very good at picking up on hidden coercion. And I always joke that, you know,
this is ringing true to me.
Yeah, they could pick up. I always say, you know, these phrases that you never thought of as controlling, like looking out the window when it stopped raining and saying, "Oh, it stopped raining." And when my children were small, they would say, "No." And I'd be like, "What, me?" And they knew that the next thing was going to be, let's go out. Stop reading, let's go out.
Yeah.
So, yes, and I agree, for many, many families. And I think it's one of those things that people outside home education, outside unschooling, don't realise at all. It's not really part of how the mainstream thinks of home education as a place where actually lots of neurodivergent children are. But that's been the case in every community I've found, home ed communities, but also the self-directed schools. These are the children who struggle with the mainstream school system. I mean, in some cases, that's almost what the diagnosis is about.
Yeah, I mean, I see them, and to me, they're very often the sort of cutting edge, aren't they? They're almost the flag bearers for all children, saying, "Do you know what? No,
This is ridiculous.
I'm not doing this.
What do you mean?"
Right,
they're the ones who able to stand up and say, "Come on."
Yeah, a lot of clarity there. Yeah. So I wonder if we could talk a little bit about why it particularly does work for these children, because I know to actually come out of the system may feel very, very scary, because it seems almost like these children need so much support. How could you possibly come out?
So I think that's a really interesting point. I think parents can quite quickly get into a whole system where they're being told, "You need support for this, you need therapy for this, you need support for this." And a lot of it is support to conform to a system. So, you know, if you're someone who finds it very, very very hard to be told what to do, for example, and therefore school is going to be really difficult for you if you're someone who finds it hard to be told what to do, because that is the bedrock of school, that you have to do what you're told to do, and you have to do what everybody else does. So even if something as simple as that is what you struggle with, you might need one-on-one support at school, someone who's going to keep kind of pushing you through the system, because when you're told what to do, you don't want to do it. So you get into this position where everything is about, let's try and modify the child or modify things around the child so mm-hmm. they cope better with this school system. But no one ever really says, hang on a minute, maybe if we didn't ask him to do things all day, then maybe things would be quite different and we wouldn't have to do all of this support, because actually he would be able to be himself. There are some of special schools that do take that approach, and it's partly because the children require it. And I always say it's a bit like very young children. Very young children often get self-directed education. If you look at what's going on in their learning, in fact, that's the majority. And it's because they simply insist. Anyone who's tried to sit down a two-year-old and start to do flashcards or things will know it's a very, very unrewarding operation. And most parents give up and say, fine, let's just play. So the young children are really good at this. Many children somehow become more persuadable as they get a bit older. And the reaction of society is to say, great, they're more persuadable. Let's persuade them to sit in a classroom and write things. Whereas some children, and these are the neurodivergent children, do not become more persuadable. They still, in many ways, show that actually they need something different. So they have a whole set of diagnoses. But really what these diagnoses are about is you don't conform to what we expect of developmental level for you, your age group, in school. I think the amazing, amazing thing that happens when a child comes out of school is that you can then start with the child and their needs and what they want to do. And for loads of children, that's completely transformatory. Yeah. Because suddenly, what matters is what they want. And that can be really hard for lots of them as well, because particularly if they've been in school for a while, because for a while they've been told it doesn't really matter what you want, or even what you want is stupid. What you know, the things you're interested in aren't what you should be interested in. Because I think the thing about neurodivergent children, again, is that their interests might be really out of kilter with other children of their age. So you can follow their own developmental trajectory. Right. And I think the place where it's easiest for people to see that is the example of reading, because obviously in school, people are expected to read by a certain age. And if you don't read by a certain age, you'll be sent for assessments and you may get a diagnosis and you'll be given extra support. And there will be a lot of anxiety around your lack of reading. And Harriet Patterson did a fabulous research study where she looked at home educated children learning to read. And she found that they learned to read between the ages of 2 and 14.
Right.
And that it didn't affect their later outcome. So children who were learning to read at 14 were still at 16 able to read at the level of a 16-year-old and were able to go to college and do things that other 16-year-olds did. Whereas children who don't learn to read until 14 at school, they don't have that kind of trajectory. So I think of it with neurodiversity, I think of it as you've got the child and you've got particular characteristics of the child or the young person. And then often school creates sort of surrounding for that of shame about those differences, distress about those differences. And also it creates an environment in which those children are disabled.
Right.
Because the things which they find difficult might be really important at school. For example, reading. If reading isn't something that comes naturally to you by age 6, you'll be diagnosed with a learning disability by the time you're 7 or 8.
Yeah.
And then here's that we know there's a whole body of work about the impact that that has on you of then being thinking of yourself as disabled,
right,
and thinking of yourself as not capable and how that can then carry through. And I think school does that and we don't need to do it, you know, out of school, we just don't need to.
Do you think, well, firstly, Harriet's book was the first book I read about education beyond school when oldest son was a toddler.
Is that How Children Learn at Home, the one with Alan Thomas? It's a great book, isn't it?
I loved it. It gave me the confidence to not push the reading.
Yeah.
And it was magical. Seeing my children learn to read by themselves at the age they wanted was phenomenal. Also, because I think we don't understand what children are doing when they're not reading. The memory, the interpreting other things, the amount of information they can hold on to.
Yeah.
And then just watching them solve the puzzle and,
yeah,
and the confidence that they acquire in themselves. It was mind-blowing to me. So I wonder at school, something that I think parents have in their heads when their children go into education is that you have to do well at school to do in life.
Yeah.
So I've thought a lot about that. And I think actually the issue is to not do badly at school. If you do badly at school, you come out with the shame. But if you take school out of the picture, actually don't have to do well at school to do well in life.
That's a really interesting way of thinking about it. Yes. I think you're right. There is something about people really wanting their children to do well at school. And I think there's something about social status.
Yeah.
Because as you say, it's not necessarily about doing brilliantly, but you don't want to be those losers in the system,
right,
do you?
Right. And it's funny because it is actually a system designed to have many lose, even the way the exams work in the UK.
That's the bit that nobody talks about. Like even now with all the narrative about closing the gap and catching up and nobody left behind, it's the way that GCSEs are set up. It's not possible to close the gap. It is impossible. If everybody got 9 A's at GCSE, they would be abolished. They would probably declare that year null and void. You know, I mean, it's not possible because they grade on a curve. But if everybody was so good, they couldn't do anything but give them all A's, they'd say, well, how are we going to distinguish between these children now? Because the whole point of school is to sort people out. It's to develop, you know, it's to say these people are going to be the winners. These are going to be the middle lot. And these lots, well, we don't know what we're going to do with you.
Yeah. Also that idea that someone is always assessing your knowledge. So the thing my kids have the hardest time with is the idea that they'd be judged by what they know. And my little child spent a few weeks in a mainstream school in Spain when we were there because his friend went there. He thought he'd try it out. And the thing that really drove him nuts was the fact that every time he did something, an adult had to say, oh, that's good.
Or, well done.
Oh, that's 7 out of 10. Or, you can say, well, why does this keep having to be judged? And what I love at home is how they are just curious about whatever they're curious about. There's no end to it. There's no goal. It's just this enormous, vast expanse of knowledge to be acquired. You want to.
It's because you're interested. To see the world like that, it makes no sense to choose something and say, right, we're going to rank everybody on this one.
Right.
You know, we're going to say, right, yes, maths. That's the really important thing. We want to know who's going to get that A in maths. Whereas Minecraft, we don't care about that. We're not interested in who's the best at Minecraft. And the judging is really interesting because I think that's another one of these things that if you go to school, you just accept as part and parcel of life that somebody else is going to look at your work and say tick or cross or good enough or not good enough. And actually, it was something I became very aware of when writing my book, because one of my anxieties when writing my book was that somebody would read it and say, no, you're wrong. You know, and I'm sure at some point probably someone will, because it's the kind of book. I found myself trying to be non-provocative, you know, trying to be kind of bland. And I had to really fight this push to make everything anodyne.
Are we back to the fear of being different, aren't we?
Yes, yes, right. I think we are. And the fear that somebody is going to say, no, that was wrong. And in fact, or that you're not really qualified enough to say this. Right. How have you got that? You know, where have you got the right to say any of this? I mean, you're not an expert. Right. Very much that kind of feeling. And in fact, the only way I managed to sort of trick myself into writing the book was that I decided I would write it, even though I thought no one would ever read it.
Ah.
And because I didn't have a publisher when I wrote it, I just wrote it. It's weird because now it feels much less niche than it did then because of the pandemic. Hmm. So because now everybody has had an experience of their children being home from school, it's like home education is kind of, you know, it's in the ether. There are articles about it in the national press all the time. But when I was writing it 2 years ago, it was this teeny niche thing, home ed niche, self-directed education niche of niche. And I thought, you know, it's possible that no one will read this, no one will publish it. And that was the only way I was able to get myself to write it.
That's so interesting. In the previous podcast, Sophie, who I was talking to, speaks to exactly that in her writing. That school thing that we have in ourselves. In fact, that leads me on to very nicely to something else in your book, which is was a little bit of guide really to de-schooling. The fact that how we are with our children really does come from our own expectations and often our experience at school, but also our experiences in life, obviously. And so in order to do this, we have to de-school ourselves really in order to allow our children this level of autonomy over themselves. So, yeah, so I think that's a really interesting chapter of the book, because I think that what a lot of times what happens is people say, oh, well, I'm going to do this. It was an educational choice. And then they realize, oh,
it's a much bigger choice than that. Yes.
Yeah, this is really hard. And the kid's getting on with it just fine. The kid has no problem whatsoever just being, living and getting on with life. And it is the parent who is really struggling with not intervening, with not making them do something else, with not judging. And everything they
have. Makes perfect sense. Yeah, we were schooled. The schooling goes very deep. Because if you look at most young children, they're very purposeful. Before they go to school, they're generally full of purpose, full of intention. They know what they want to do and where they want to do it. And it's really, they pull their parents along behind them. And then at school, that is literally taken away. The control is taken away. And now it's about you doing what you're told. And we are the people who are going to give you the purpose. And I think that's something really profound, which I don't think education has properly grappled with, because most of what passes for alternative or progressive or different education doesn't really engage with this idea of coercion and of what we do by adults deciding this is what children are going to do for 12 years of their life. Just how profoundly that affects a human being to have that taken away from them. And we don't realize it because it was done to us. And so we do it to our children. And because we believe and we're told that this is the only way. And that's why I think self-directed education is so radical, because it says, but it's not. We know it's not the only way. So if it's not the only way, then that means it is a choice to take away the power from these children, to take away control from these children and to put them in this situation. It's not inevitable. And because that's usually what children think and what their parents say, you know, yes, I know you maybe you don't like some aspects of school, but you have to go to school. There's no choice kind of thing. So if we're saying, but there is choice, they can learn in another way. I think that's quite mind blowing for lots of people, because it does mean suddenly, OK, so then we're voluntarily doing this, actually. And if we're voluntarily doing it, is it worth it?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. I think also what's quite mind-blowing or radical is the idea that we're taking away a certainty. The certainty, in my opinion, is entirely an illusion, but it's kind of there, right? So at 16, it's this, at 18, it's this, and then it's this and this and this. And we all know, anyone over the age of what should we say, 30, 40, 50, you know that life's quite random, a lot more random than
we're led to believe.
Our children.
Yeah.
So here, if I look at these three, I see they're so different. I couldn't really tell you what's going to be like in 5 years' time. Really don't have a clue. Every now and again, I have an inkling or ideas come up, but I couldn't tell you. And so that mystery of life, that not knowing, because I'm not plotting it for them, you've got to get comfortable with that, haven't you?
Absolutely. And I think you have to get comfortable with that a lot earlier than schooling parents do, because, you know, in my experience, I was there with my 6-year-old or 7-year-old discovering that he didn't want to go to all the home ed groups that I thought we would be spending our time with and that I would like to be spending my time with. He didn't want to do all these things. And that's why I think unschooling parents come up against this reality that your child is a different person to you really early on. You know, many parents do channel their children through a system to make them hopefully something a bit like them. And you choose a school that you think matches your values as a parent and as a family, and you kind of mold the child into the what you were expecting. And with unschooling, obviously you do mold, you know, your environment is very much chosen by you, by the parents, at least to the extent of usually your house and where it is and that kind of thing. But what the child actually does within that is far more driven by the child. And it's so interesting you've got. So, I mean, this is back to neurodiversity again, really, you see. It's, you can see diversity right there.
Yeah, but it's interesting. Yeah, but you just see differences and different passions and different interests. Yesterday, I came across the phrase radical acceptance, which I thought was lovely, which was in the actually in the context of neurodiversity. But that idea of radical acceptance, you are who you are, and that's okay. And I think that that is the step you've got to really take, isn't it?
Yes, and I'm not going to try and mold you into something else other than who you are, or I'm not going to try and get you to fill this mold that I thought you were going to be when I imagined having a baby. And I think that's a particularly painful process actually for parents whose children are very different to what they thought they would get. Mm-hmm. And also maybe for parents who've been, so I'm thinking about neurodivergent children whose parents have been through the school system and through the diagnostic system and through the system of seeing their children really, really struggle and really fail at school.
Yeah.
And everybody's concerned and everybody's kind of sort of anxious. And it's really hard for parents to see that happen to their child. But it also happens to the parent as well, because you're both in it. You know, parents feel very judged by professionals. One of the reasons I'm trying to put myself out there as a professional is that I know parents who are brave enough to say, this is enough, we're not going to do school anymore. They get a lot of slack from professionals, because professionals generally believe that the best place for a child is in school, any right. child, and that no matter how difficult it is, if they're not in school, what will happen instead? You know, we just have no cultural narrative.
But we're back to fear, aren't we? This is yes. just what will happen. Children here with all their random interests.
What will they do? Exactly. Yeah. That's the thing. And school provides an illusion of progress and an illusion yeah. of a linear structure. But for some people it is. But also, I mean, even for people like myself who do fill all the boxes, do all the exams and everything, you still get to a certain point where you fall off the end of that. And yeah. I remember it feeling quite a lot like falling off the end of that. It's like, you know, yeah. my whole life has been structured. Like, even if I took a gap year, I knew it was a gap year, because then mm-hmm. I would come back to do the next thing. It's like a series of steps. And then you get to the top and you're like, and now what? Right. I just get a job. Is yeah. that it?
Well, that's so interesting. With these guys, I just think, you know, in the future, I just see them very strong in their knowledge of what they like, what they don't like. They're so used to knowing how to manage their lives. So it's interesting. They're yeah. incredibly independent in that sense. So Naomi, I wonder, so perhaps you could address, what do parents of neurodiverse children need to know if they are thinking themselves of finding an alternative to mainstream education?
So I think the most important thing to know is that there is a real alternative. And that this isn't about your child dropping out. It isn't about them being a failure. This is about them needing something really different. And what they are doing is they're showing up the flaws in the school system and the way in which school can't work for everybody. And I think that that is something to celebrate, because we need people to tell us that kind of thing. And I know that the process is often hugely damaging for parents and for children, that they've often had a really bad time. And it's an enormously brave thing to do, to come out, because everybody will tell you you're making the wrong decision. You shouldn't, you know, you're giving up. That's what people will say. You shouldn't give up. But it's not about giving up. And I think the way to think about it is that you're not dropping out. You're dropping in to self-directed education. You're dropping into something really different. And the potential of that, particularly for a neurodivergent child, is that they can take back responsibility for their lives. They can learn how to manage their own differences and how to manage their own quirks, how to live in a world that doesn't accommodate them. Because I think this is one of the things people are always worried about. How will, you know, if I don't force them to go to school, how are they ever going to learn how to accommodate the world? You know, don't they have to learn to get on with the real life, real world? School isn't the real world. I have never, since I left school, been made to do the things I was made to do at school. So that never happens again, where you've got such a rigid system. And I think a helpful way to think about our neurodivergent children is about children who need a lot of flexibility from the world around them. And school can't provide that for them in most cases. But as they grow up, they will know what kind of flexibility they need around them if we give them the chances to learn that. Right. And that is an absolute superpower for them as they go off into the adult world. If they know, you know, if I'm in a large group of people, about half an hour is what I can cope with. And then I need to just go off and have a bit of time by myself playing a video game or something. That's a great thing to know about yourself, rather than what many people do, which is say, go off into a large group of people, find it all really overwhelming, and say, get drunk, because they don't know how to deal with this level of overwhelm that they've got. And they don't feel it's okay to say, you know what, this is my limit. I need to go now. And yeah. I think when these children are in school, they are prevented from learning their limits, because they're not allowed to leave. They're not allowed to put their own boundaries. They're not allowed to say, actually, you know what? I don't like any of you guys. I don't want to be friends with you. I just, you know, I'm happier by myself. Thanks very much. They're not right. allowed to say those things. And by allowing our children to say those things through their education, but I hope that they can develop into fully whole adults who accept themselves and who will know how to manage their own characteristics in the world.
Yeah. Fully whole adults. I think that's absolutely lovely. Who know how to engage in a way that's healthy to them. So not losing themselves in the world, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And who don't think of themselves as inadequate or as failures or as less than.
Right.
Which is unfortunately what I see with when I work with autistic adults. A lot of what they talk about at school is being made to feel less than.
Right.
Or feeling that they weren't good enough. And I think if we can avoid that for our children, then that in itself is just amazing, really, apart from anything else they do.
Great. Oh, well, thank you, Naomi. We're going to leave it on that note. That's absolutely what we would all love for our children. And seeing them in managing their own lives and what incredibly interesting, passionate people they are, and seeing them as the whole authentic beings that they are.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Hooray to that. Great. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
So much more to talk about.
I can go on and on.
Yeah. And thank you for your wonderful book. I'm going to put in the notes for people who would like to look that up. So Changing Our Minds, really interesting book for anybody even thinking about self-directed learning or who's already in the process. So thank you, Naomi.
Thank you. Bye.